Today on Vox Talks Economics, as the SEC makes it easier to invest in crypto, what do we know about who holds it and why? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. And every week we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, follow us, subscribe, find us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics.
What do you want people to take away from Project Crypto?
So it is a new day at the SEC, and we are picking up the gauntlet that and the challenge that President Trump has laid down to make America, the crypto capital of the world and to have the world running on U.S. technology.
Recent regulatory shifts in the United States have paved the way for broader access to cryptocurrency exchange-traded funds. With the SEC also signaling a more crypto-friendly stance, it looks like many more households will soon be in the market for crypto investments.
There are a lot of ways that we can help do that, and that is provide regulatory certainty and good rules that are fit for purpose for the crypto industry so that innovators know how to innovate and investors know what they're investing in.
A CEPR discussion paper called Do You Even Crypto, Bro? It's not just financial investments that crypto's changing, it's the names of research papers too, apparently. Summarizes what a representative sample of US citizens think about these investments and highlights the gap in attitudes to risk and investing between crypto holders and the rest of the population. Michael Weber of Purdue is one of the authors. He joins me now. Michael, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hey, Tim, it's a pleasure to be with you today. Looking forward to our conversation.
Tell me about this research, first of all. What inspired it?
We started working on this topic in 2018, jointly with Yuri Gordnichenko from Berkeley and Oli Corbillon at UT Austin. And while discussing among the three of us, we realized that there was very little evidence and knowledge on who's holding crypto, why they are holding it. Well, actually, maybe it's also the case that the three of us actually didn't have much clue of crypto at the time. So we went out there and wanted to look at the, I guess what people say, the horse mouth, to see what kind of the general population knows and thinks about crypto.
There might not be as much knowledge as we would hope for, but there's certainly no lack of opinions about crypto. Investment professionals, first of all, what has the range of opinions from them been about the usefulness of cryptocurrencies as an investment?
Yeah, that's actually great that you bring that up. And as you alluded to, there's just this huge differences in views and opinions. On the one hand, you have a star investor like Warren Buffett, who at some point famously called Bitcoin is probably rat poison squared. Yeah. And on the other hand, you have people like Larry Fink of BlackRock, who said, given the VC like the US federal debt spiking and actually continue to increase going forward, that maybe Bitcoin could even replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And then you have people that move from one camp to the other, so like Jamie Dimon, at some point called Bitcoin or crypto more generally a Ponzi scheme. And more recently, actually, his view has changed somewhat. And he said, maybe there is a role for crypto in people's investment portfolios. It's not only that there are huge differences of opinion, there's also like transition of views among people themselves over time.
Okay, so that's finance professionals. What about economists? What opinions have they had about the same question?
Even among economists, I think there's the saying, you ask two economists, get three opinions or something along the lines. And very similarly, it's also here the case that views are very different. So like one thing you often hear is that crypto is ultimately serves a role as a currency. And you can think about that similar to like fiat currency, take the pound or the US dollar. It is used as a unit of account or a store of value, but also as a medium of exchange. Of course, if you then look a little bit more closely, can it be used as a medium of exchange? At least at the moment in West Lafayette, I can't go to the bakery and purchase bread with it. So like there's certainly still a little bit of way to go, but maybe in other countries, it's a more easy means of payment. But similarly to fiat currency, you could ask, does it have intrinsic value? And at the end of the day, it has value because others think it has value. And so that's also like the view among economists. Some people think it's just another bubble. Others think it's kind of the digital currency of the future. And, you know, in the end, it can derive value because others think it has value. And useless versus valuable and anything in between.
And of course, we can't avoid, for anyone who's been following the story of cryptocurrencies, we cannot avoid the origin story, which was very much tied up in the financial counterculture, let's call it that. Illegal purchases, fraud, as a boom bust, very high volatility asset. Is all of that behind us now?
Now, you know, coming maybe first to the very last word you mentioned, volatility. Just look at the price movements and swings there are of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. I think volatility is just a very inherent feature of cryptocurrencies. Now, you also alluded to fraud and illicit transactions. Maybe that's the closest similarity you can think of to paper currency. Like, why is the dollar so much in circulation? It's just because it's also used for illicit transactions. And this is still the case. If I want to engage in transactions that people cannot trace me back to, maybe a cryptocurrency could be very attractive. Inherently, it's set up in such a way that ultimately I can always trace back where the cryptocurrency is created and coming from. But as long as I can camouflage or hide my identity, maybe I can still use it successfully if I wanted in illegal transactions. But, you know, I think summarizing, certainly like you've seen early on, widespread fraud and use in illicit transactions, which is still the case, however, maybe to a lesser extent. And similarly, however, now with the spread of fake coins and memecoins and other schemes, people try to impersonate celebrities to give investment advice into fraudulent coins. Like, you know, I think it's still pretty much in the field of illicit transactions and fraud.
So you did the first wave of research for this in 2023. Now I believe that you've just finished another wave as well. It's a fast-moving story with plenty of surprises along the way. But what questions were you trying to answer with this research?
In 23, we posted the first version of our research paper, but actually the data collection goes back way further. We, in fact, actually started in 2018. And at the beginning, it was more like, do even people invest in it? And which share of their portfolio is invested in crypto? And then in the summer of 21 and 22, we had two larger survey waves in the field in the US. And we tried to understand among the people that are holding crypto, why they are holding it, how big of a share of their portfolio is it, others that actually don't invest in it, why are they not investing it? And then we also were interested in, you know, do the swings and prices of Bitcoin ultimately transmit into the spending and buying behavior of people? Does it actually affect maybe the outlook for inflation or the overall economy, the sentiment more generally? And ultimately, we wanted to also see whether we, as researchers, if we were to provide information to those that actually currently don't hold crypto, could we potentially shape their view and maybe even shape the investment behavior going forward?
There have been over the years plenty of market research press releases from crypto exchanges, for example. You don't have to go very far to find out what the opinions of crypto investors are. Why do you need to do separate research? Why is your research going to add value to this?
On the one hand, imagine, you know, I want to sell you oranges. And then I tell you, if you buy oranges, you live until 150. Maybe you should be a little bit skeptical. So like similarly, if you want people to invest in crypto, of course, you could be concerned that if I'm running a crypto exchange, that my research is not necessarily unbiased. So that's maybe the first one. Independent academic research has value because it adds a little bit of an unbiased view to the discussion. At the same time, if you purely look at people holding crypto, It's really hard to say, well, you know, the big chunk of the population that's not holding crypto, why are they not holding crypto? Similarly, if you just look at account data or like exchange data, you do see that some people hold it. Maybe you can get some information on the demographics of those people. But in general, again, like it's hard to say, how do they look like? Why do they hold it? Why others don't hold it? So it's really hard to compare among holders and non-holders, why people holding it or not hold it, and even like what their views on maybe even other financial investments are. That's the gap we wanted to fill in a little bit.
First of all, a very basic question. What proportion of the population is holding cryptocurrency assets at the moment?
We've been running those quarterly surveys on what is called the Nielsen Homescan panel since 2018.
Right.
And roughly speaking, we have between like 20 and 25,000 representative consumers that are spread out across the whole US that answer our surveys. Starting in 2018, most people, in fact, didn't have any holdings in crypto. And so it was only about like 2% of this representative sample of 25,000 Americans that had any holdings of crypto in their portfolio. By 2020, that increased to roughly 5%. Then in 22, we are already about 12%. And then in our most recent survey in April of this year, plateauing off at around 14% at the moment.
So as yet, it's still not a majority of the population or anything like it, isn't it? Are crypto investors different to the general population along important dimensions for us?
Yeah, you partially give it away already when referring to our paper title.
Yeah.
What you do see in the data is that holders of crypto are predominantly men, typically younger. They tend to have higher income and higher wealth. Interestingly, they're less likely to be white. And in terms of political views, they're more likely to support the Libertarian Party relative to Democrats, Independents, or Republicans. When I say that, I don't want to give the idea that anything I say here is causal. Those are purely correlations in the data, and this is a multivariate correlation, so to speak.
Tell me about what they're telling you attracts them to crypto. Is it the return on investment? Is it because they're going to make money out of it? Or are they mentioning these other ideological, perhaps, reasons for owning crypto?
In our first two detailed waves in the summers of 21, 22, we did see, like, you know, there were three broad reasons why people were holding crypto. By far the most important reason why people invest in crypto, they say, I expect a very high return over the next 12 months.
Right.
And crypto has a low correlation with the other assets in my portfolio. So then in that sense, it sounds like a standard investment motive, you know, high expected return, lower correlation with other assets, what I teach my MBA students.
Yeah.
You know, you certainly should have a high share of such an asset in your portfolio. The second most important, as a classical motive of any currency, would be a store of value and then explicitly also hedge against inflation. Again, like this was summer of 21 and 22. The third most important set of reasons was that holders of cryptocurrencies stated that they wanted to be independent of banks, contribute to the development of cryptos, so in that sense, more like a crypto mindset and being independent of the existing financial system. And maybe that also is flavoring in with the view that it's mainly supporters of the Libertarian Party that want to be independent of the current system.
Let's talk a bit about that hedge against inflation, because I guess around 22, 23, that was extremely salient. How did that work out for them? How were they deciding it was going to be a hedge against inflation?
If you actually looked at what people wrote in some of those open-ended text boxes, you did see like arguments, you know, the supply of Bitcoin is limited, so therefore it should be a good store of value. And in fact, actually, it should be hedging against the debasement of the US dollar because of maybe of the printing press, maybe because of an increase in federal debt in the US might ultimately lose its value. Now, actually, if you look at the data, inflation spiked up, the stock market tanked. What did cryptocurrency do? They largely tanked as well. And you know, if you ask people again in April of this year, why are you holding crypto? Pretty much no one states anymore because I want to hedge against inflation. I think like when people understood or realized that empirically, at least in this episode we all witnessed in the last couple of years, cryptocurrencies were not really good hedge by and large against headline inflation, and such people don't actually state it anymore.
Well, if as an investment strategy it didn't work out, at least they're looking at the data. Tell me a little bit about people who are not investing in crypto. Are they using the same criteria to evaluate crypto, or are they just choosing not to think about it?
The most common reason non-holders of crypto state that why they are not holding cryptos, I know too little about it, I didn't come about thinking about it, I don't even know what it is. So like, you know, reasons to say, well, as of now, at least they don't have enough information. The second most important set of reasons is similar to the holders of crypto. Non-holders of crypto also mention financial reasons in the sense that they expect a low return going forward. They say it's a poor addition to my existing portfolio. Cryptocurrencies are too volatile. And some also say, like, well, I just don't have the means to invest in them. But it's mainly like lack of knowledge or information on the one hand, but then financial reasons that similar to how we started out with. You know, there's also a pretty widespread heterogeneity or differences in opinion among holders and non-holders of cryptocurrency.
Now, I think as part of this research, you gave non-holders some information about the historical returns to owning crypto. When you did that change their attitude to it?
Yes, we provided both in the summer of 21, but also again then in 22, information about past returns of crypto, both in the short and the medium horizon, past return information about the S&P 500, information about the fluctuation or the volatility of these assets. And so what we tried to do, and you know, sometimes you hear that it's like an information provision experiment or a randomized controlled trial. Some people in the survey get this information, others don't get it in a randomized fashion so that we as researchers then can make causal statements, cause and effect. So like, what is the role of the information on subsequent investment behavior? And you actually did see in the summer of 21, when most of the information about past crypto returns was positive, that non-owners in particular did increase their willingness to invest in crypto. And then through follow-up survey waves, given that we used this panel data I alluded to earlier, we actually indeed see that people increase their holdings of cryptocurrencies after they received information about positive returns in the past relative to the subset of our survey participants that were not provided with that information. Then we move forward by 12 months in the summer of 2022, when we redid the same type of survey experiment, but this time, especially like the most recent returns over the last 12 months of crypto were highly negative. You actually did see like some asymmetry in the sense that it is not the case that people started divesting or wanted to sell cryptocurrency. And so in that sense, you know, if you now put those two pieces together, a strong flow into crypto, if returns in the past are positive, but no outflow or desired divestment when returns are negative, that can ultimately help us understand why maybe you see price swings and ultimately how bubbles potentially are formed.
Now, over the period of this survey, there have been plenty of people owning crypto who have regular, quite positive news about the value of their assets. When they get this positive news, how do they respond to it?
If you now think about it, like what would portfolio theory tell you what you should do if like an asset does extremely well?
Yeah. You'd
say, well, maybe you think about again, expected returns going forward, the correlation of these assets, and maybe you want to rebalance your portfolio, in particular like assets that have appreciated a lot. Maybe you want to lower the inflated or increased portfolio share. If you look at the data, that's not what people do. If anything, they double down and want to buy more. And then what do they actually do in the case they partially divest? You actually see like if the value of crypto goes up a lot, they tend to go out, they're happy, you know, good investor sentiment. I look at my portfolio, I see like I must be really smart. Returns are super, super positive. Mm-hmm. What a smart cookie am I? The people go out and treat themselves. They buy larger ticket items. They go on holidays. There's even evidence people like buying cars in our survey, vacation packages. Do people also increase their non-durable consumption? Do I now buy more milk? Or maybe, you know, as a good German, I drink a Weissbier because like my portfolio is doing well. You don't see that. Crypto is more similar to like a lottery win, maybe a small one, relative to like, you know, other financial assets. Because if this S&P 500 increases a lot in value, you see people increase both their non-durable and their durable purchases. If you look at lottery wins instead, typically people only increase their durable purchases and not non-durable purchases. In that sense, maybe, you know, people understand a little bit, maybe that you know, the swings in crypto are not only one-sided, it might also come down again. But in that sense, we don't persistently increase our overall consumption, but only limit it in certain kind of durable goods categories.
The idea that private money like cryptocurrency can be a hedge against inflation was first set out by Friedrich Hayek half a century ago. In our episode from January 2025 called Do Cryptocurrencies Matter? Bruno Bier describes how this could work and in which countries in the world we already see investors using crypto holdings this way. Listen when you follow us, wherever you get your podcasts.
So this is fascinating research, especially the dimension that you have of it now going back 7 or 8 years. Can we conclude from this that the crypto investors, who now, if there were 8 people in a room, one of them would be that crypto investor, can we conclude that that person is somehow systematically different from the other 7?
Certainly in terms of sociodemographics, there are some differences. Stephen Colbert famously said, crypto is gold for nerds, but with a twist. That's a pretty good description. Crypto holders, non-crypto holders, gold holders, non-gold holders, similar features. Crypto owners instead are way more likely to be male and younger relative to gold holders that, if anything, tend to be slightly older. And non-holders of crypto are just so much more likely to state, I don't even know what crypto is. Mm-hmm. If I don't hold gold, I'm not saying I don't know what gold is. It's like gold for nerds with a little twist, I would say.
We see the way that crypto is reported now in the financial press, for example, becoming much more similar to the way that other financial assets are reported. People owning the assets now, are they more similar than they were back at the beginning of your research?
That's certainly the case that some of the differences we discussed earlier are somewhat more muted in the April wave of this year. But overall, it's still the case. It's younger, better off, kind of, you know, more digitally minded people. But in general, you do certainly also see, like, when it comes to stock investment, that men are more likely to hold stocks relative to women. So, like, in that sense, it's not any special, but certainly among other dimensions, the differences are pretty stark still, even in April of this year.
Let's think about the behavior of the asset rather than the people owning it. The SEC's revised positions on ownership, it's definitely going to lead to wider ownership, you would imagine. Do you think that this will reduce or increase the volatility in the underlying crypto assets? And if more people are holding it in their investment portfolios, the volatility in those portfolios?
That's a tough one. In general, I would think that for most financial assets, the more retail investors are holding it, the more short investment horizons, the higher is the volatility, given there's oftentimes also a stronger reaction to past returns and past news. If you now see a widespread increase in holdings by retail investors, I would think that volatility most likely will stay high or keep increasing. But again, it's really hard to predict, especially if it's about the future, as we all know.
If there are millions more people investing in crypto, just because it's easy and just because there's more information, what might be the good scenario for households and the economy? What might be the bad scenario coming out of this?
Let's maybe start with the latter to be able to kind of finish maybe on an optimistic note. Like, imagine I have 100% of my portfolio invested in crypto. And the price, you know, I invest when it's at 50,000, the price goes to 60,000. And then within a year, it actually goes to 15,000. Mm-hmm. Now, most of my retirement savings are wiped out. If that happens to me when I'm in my 20s and 30s, maybe that's no big deal. If it happens to me when I'm close to retirement, maybe that's way more problematic. Now, the fact that it's largely younger people currently holding crypto would suggest they still have time to recover their retirement wealth. But, you know, given that we, as you alluded to, might expect now an increase in the general population, also maybe among the people closer to retirement age investing in crypto, that's, of course, then a very problematic scenario. Now, on the bright side, it's, of course, also from like 15,000, it actually, of course, recovered. And then the question is, do I hold on or am I a classical retail investor after kind of bad returns at their best? That's, of course, bad. But if I actually keep holding on and at some point it crosses 120,000, now maybe my initial investment is more than doubled. And then maybe I can buy a new house, maybe I can buy new durable goods. But of course, it's always crucial. What is my investment horizon? Do I divest when I see past returns that are negative, or do I hold on to it? And so in the end, it might be an asset that's good addition to an existing portfolio, but not investing all money in a single asset is certainly a good idea. And in that sense, it should be considered as any other financial asset.
One thing we can be sure is that there are many more surprises to come in this story. Thank you for bringing us up to date with the story so far, Michael.
Thank you, Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you about our work.
If you want to read the discussion paper from CEPR, it is discussion paper 20089, Do You Even Crypto Bro? Cryptocurrencies in Household Finance. The authors Michael Weber, Bernardo Candia, Olivier Coibillon, and Yuri Gorodnichenko. I imagine, Michael, that there will be some more updates coming to this.
Yeah, still working on it. And yes, stay tuned. We'll have an update to the working paper in the next couple of months.
Stay tuned, and I'm sure we're going to be talking again about this, but thanks for now.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, where gender-biased norms come from and why they won't go away.